dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. An article by Dave Lindorf, titled War, Protest, and the Press, The Failure of American Journalism, appeared in the recent edition of the political newsletter Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org. It began as follows. The abject failure of the American journalistic model, long worsening, has become depressingly apparent in the run-up to what appears to be almost certain war with Iraq. Although there are clear and rational and compelling arguments being made against the war both at home and abroad by professional soldiers, seasoned diplomats, and millions of ordinary people, the American corporate media, both print and electronic, have become virtual parrots of the administration line that war is necessary because Saddam Hussein is evil and a clear threat to America. If the administration's warning that a terror strike was imminent and that Americans should all buy plastic sheeting and duct tape to enable them to protect their homes in the event of a gas or germ attack was akin to someone shouting fire in a crowded theater, the resulting panic stoked by the media's breathless and uncritical repeating of that self-serving nonsense was like a gang of ushers echoing the cry while goading theatergoers into a stampede for the exits. Some critics of the media have blamed this on a conspiracy, a conscious desire on the part of the corporate media to support a pro-corporate government agenda. While there certainly is a commonality of interest, particularly as the major media have fallen into the hands of just a few giant corporate holding companies, there is something else at work, too. Ordinarily, jaded and cynical journalists and their editors seem of late to have entirely lost their grounding in reality. Constrained for years by a tradition that requires them to remain scrupulously, quote, objective and devoid of ideology, they have allowed themselves to be manipulated into the role of little more than purveyors of government press releases. Standard American journalistic practice calls for reporters to recount faithfully what they are told by official sources, and then to go to the other side for comment. But where war is concerned, the other side is perceived as the enemy and is deemed not worthy of comment. Ordinarily, the other easy source of critical comment on government pronouncements and opinions would be the opposition party. But in this instance, with a war in the offing, the Democrats, not much in the way of opposition in any case, have become largely silent, afraid of being labeled unpatriotic. That has left the administration with a free hand to present its case for war in Iraq in the corporate media virtually without comment or criticism. How different things are in the UK, where newspapers are expected to have their own political viewpoints, and where journalists are permitted, even expected, to have opinions. Dave Lindorf, writing in Counterpunch. Tonight we're going to devote the program to a lecture by Dr. Robert Fisk, foreign correspondent for the London Independent. Fisk is the UK's, if not the world's, foremost English-language journalist covering the Middle East. He spoke on February 5th at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His topic, ask all you like about 9/11, but for heaven's sake, don't ask why.
Ladies and gentlemen, one reason for my hoarseness is that I spent today rushing down to New York to sit in the UN Security Council chamber and watch Colin Powell. I think you learn a lot more about people when you see them in the flesh, when you notice who falls asleep, George Tenet of the CIA. And who sounds most pompous? Our own dear Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw. I have to say I was not impressed. Sources, foreign intelligence sources, our sources, defectors, sources, sources, sources. Colin Powell's terror talk, the United Nations Security Council, sounded like one of those government-inspired reports on the front page of the New York Times, where, of course, Mr. Powell's speech will no doubt be treated with due reverence tomorrow morning's edition. It was a bit like heating up old soup, as the Algerians say. Hadn't we heard a lot of this before? Should we trust this man? Powell, not Saddam, I mean. Certainly we don't trust Saddam, and I certainly don't. But Secretary of State Powell's presentation today was a mixture of awesomely funny recordings of Iraqi Republican Guard telephone intercepts, a bit like listening to Samuel Beckett in Arabic. How many of you actually listen to them? Yeah, you know what I mean. Hello, 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 hello. It's a wonderful one. But which just might have contained some very unpleasant proof that, yes, Saddam is again cheating the inspectors. I'm still waiting, by the way, to hear the Arabic for the State Department's translation of, "Okay, buddy, consider it done, sir." I never heard that in Iraq before, but, you know, translators, never trust them. Then there was the artistic illustration of mobile biolabs. I don't know if you saw them on television. Wonderfully beautiful, brand-new 10-wheel trucks and astonishingly clean railway wagons, which suggests that the Pentagon has not the slightest idea of the dilapidated nature of the Iraqi army. It was when we went back to Halabja and human rights abuses and all Saddam's old sins, all of them true, that I think the whole thing became a little bit discredited. We mentioned also UNSCOM, endless reports again of what UNSCOM did, forgetting, of course, that one of the reasons they no longer cooperated with UNSCOM is that it was proved that the CIA was involved with them. And, of course, there's a man sitting just behind Mr. Powell who knew that very well. Jack Straw may have thought of this the most powerful and authoritative case against Iraq, but when we were forced to listen to Iraq's officer corps commenting on the phone, "Yes, yes, you understand, yes," it was impossible not to ask oneself if Colin Powell had really considered the effect of all this stuff on the outside world. From time to time, the words Iraq, failure to disclose, denial and deception appeared on a giant video screen above Mr. Powell. Many of us wondered if this was CNN. But no, it turned out it was the work of CNN's sister channel, the US Department of State. Because Colin Powell is supposed to be the good cop in the Bush-Rumsfeld bad cop routine, one wants to believe him. He's a nice guy. I must say that the Iraqi officer's telephoned order to his subordinate, quote, "remove nerve agents whenever it comes up in the wireless instructions," sounded perfectly genuine. It looked indeed as if the Americans had indeed spotted a nasty new little line in Iraqi deception. We've got to be fair about that. But a dramatic picture of a pilotless drone aircraft, a little model aircraft, a little tiny aircraft, capable of spraying poisonous chemicals, turned out to be the imaginative work of a Pentagon artist. See what it says in the New York Times tomorrow morning under the caption. It just says, "Iraqi plane" or "imaginative artistic work of." When Powell started going on about decades of contact between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, things went wrong. You see, as we all know, decades ago, Al-Qaeda's men and bin Laden was working for us. Well, it's true that we also had Saddam working for us at that period, but I don't think we were cross-fertilizing our allies. And we also had Colin Powell's new version of the President's State of the Union fib, the one about the scientists interviewed by the UN inspectors being, in fact, intelligence agents. You remember Mr. Blix objected to this and said it wasn't true. I'm sure it's not. The UN now, according to the new Powell version, they were scientists being interviewed by the UN, but they weren't the right scientists. They weren't actually nuclear ones. So the lie is being softened a bit. That was a good sign. Mr. Powell said that America was sharing its information with the UN inspectors. But it was clear, if you listen carefully to his speech, that much of what he had to say about the alleged new weapons, some of which may well be true, the decontamination truck at Taji, for example, the chemical munitions factory at Ibn al-Haytham, on November 25th, had not been given to the UN inspectors. Why not? Didn't 1441 say that all intelligence information should go to Hans Blix? Is America perhaps not being quite as proactive as it should? The worst moment came, I thought, when Mr. Powell started talking about anthrax and the 2001 anthrax attacks in Washington and New York. Because the implication, of course, was that there was a Saddamite element to this, although most of us know that's almost certainly untrue. There was this point where he held up a teaspoon of imaginary spores. I wondered what was coming next. Actually, it was another teaspoon, I think, but I couldn't see too clearly on the desk. When the Secretary of State held up Iraq's support for the Palestinian Hamas organization, which has an office in Baghdad, and also, by the way, in Beirut and Damascus and Tehran, are they next? One did begin to wonder what this meant. Of course, he didn't mention America's support for Israel and Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. That wasn't there. You know, I thought one of the most macabre moments came when Powell entered the Security Council, backslapping, kissing on the side of the face, various delegates and diplomats around him. Jack Straw, our foreign secretary, I noticed, positively bounded up for his big American hug. There were moments, you know, when you might have thought this was a gathering of statesmen to celebrate peace. They were so happy. Alas, of course, they were planning a war, which may indeed kill the monster Saddam and will indeed kill innocent people. One recalled, of course, standing in that auditorium another day, almost 30 decades ago, when one of Mr. Powell's predecessors, Adlai Stevenson, showed very clear photographs of a ship carrying Soviet rockets to Cuba. I have to say that my colleagues and I, on reflection, felt that today's pictures carried no such authority. Colin Powell is no Adlai Stevenson. Fisk's report from the Security Council comes to an end. It's a long way to New York by road, I discovered today. But the thrust of all this, the thrust of the whole message today from Secretary Powell, the narrative line, again, as always, revolved around one thing, September the 11th. Ladies and gentlemen, September the 11th, 2001, did not change the world. I tell my colleagues all the time, please stop printing and broadcasting those words. Over and over after September the 11th, this has become one of the outstanding, dangerous lies that we journalists have been propagating. September the 11th may have given President George W. Bush an excuse to change the world, but that, I believe, should be exposed for what it is, a manipulation of grief and fear in order to start a war that has nothing to do with the international crimes against humanity, which took place in New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, just 2001, just a year and 4 months ago. And it is a war that is being planned against a country, yes, led by a monster, that has absolutely nothing to do with those atrocities. On September 12th last year, following my normal pattern, I went to the United Nations General Assembly to watch Mr. Bush. You know, when you see statesmen and political figures on television, there's a kind of flatness. The screen accommodates what they do and makes it somehow more amorphous with one's own existence. When you see them in the flesh, it's very different. I was quite frightened watching Bush on September 12th last year. Anyway, I sat in the General Assembly, and he started what I fear is an American attempt to reshape the Middle East, to rewrite the history of a region which is white hot with anger at the United States. It will, I suspect, be the most frightening attempt to change the map of the Middle East since Britain and France, victors over the Ottoman Empire, divided up the spoils of the 1914-1918 war. We heard Mr. Bush's increasingly violent demands for an attack on Iraq and regime change elsewhere in the region. And be sure when it starts, and it already is beginning, our television broadcasters will use their familiar lines at the bottom of the screen, War on Terror. In the days and weeks that followed September the 11th, 2001, I became increasingly disturbed by the vapid, hopeless, gutless, unchallenging journalism which passed for coverage in the Western media. The terrifying events of September 11th were mutated into a kind of movie. America at War, War on Terrorism, War on Terror. Often, these titles would appear in a kind of laminated gold typeface on the screen, the kind that once appeared in American biblical epics like Ben-Hur, my old friend Charlton Heston. And each newscast would be introduced with an orchestral theme tune, a TV jingle to bring you back from the coffee to watch the next episode of the war. I felt that this obscured realities, just as I also feared it dishonoured the dead of September the 11th. And just as in the 1991 Gulf War, when we were treated to the hapless pictures of journalists wearing army costumes, so CNN's man at Kandahar in 2001 was among the first to put on a Marine helmet. I must say, back in 1991, I remember all these soldiers, we thought they were journalists coming in from America in their costumes. One journalist turned up with camouflaged boots, and painted on the boots were leaves. Now, those of you who've seen a desert or been in a desert will be aware... I actually wrote about the helmet on the CNN man's head in Kandahar, and CNN replied that the US Marines had insisted that their reporter wear a helmet. This is no excuse. Journalists have no business obeying military orders that make them look like combatants. And when so many of our colleagues accept these orders, as they did in the 1991 Gulf War, or when they turn up with a pistol in Jalalabad in October and November of 2001, this I'm talking about Geraldo Rivera of Fox News, claiming they want to shoot Osama bin Laden, is it any wonder that we journalists become targets of attack? We lost 11 of our colleagues in Afghanistan. But my talk to you tonight is not about the dangers to journalists. It's about the dangers now posed for journalism itself, the facile, unquestioning acceptance of authority and of the trite and bland and deeply misleading government statements which are parroted and then blended into titles and headlines. From the very start, I predicted in my newspaper, The Independent, that this was not a war on terror, but a war against America's enemies and most probably Israel's enemies, which is what it is turning out to be. Yet we went along. Indeed, we still go along, despite all the evidence, in calling this a war on terror, a war for democracy, a war against evil. Newsweek last year, certainly the New York edition, carried a front page headline which read, "The Evil One." You know who that was, of course. But not content with allowing governments, you see, to become TV headline writers, journalists were now using biblical authority for their stories. We, the West, democracy, the forces of good, we were the ones that suffered, of course. And all over the anniversary last year of September 11th, and be sure this year too, we will have to suffer again. But of course, when the anniversary of the bombardment of Afghanistan fell due in the late autumn of last year, did we carry long and moving accounts of the thousands of innocent Afghans we killed? Did we help? Let me first ask you one question. When did we first hear of the Iraqi dimension of September the 11th? The one that we were hearing so loudly today, cymbals and drums in the Security Council. When did we first suggest that Saddam was in the picture? Did anyone say back then, September 11th, 2001, and the days and weeks and months that followed, that did anyone say after these crimes against humanity then that Iraq would be in the firing line? I don't remember anyone saying that, and nor do you, I think. Where exactly did the slippage come? At what point did Osama bin Laden fade away to be replaced by Saddam Hussein? Our journalists, who should have picked up this up at once, were silent, far from doing their job alerting readers and viewers to this astonishing transition in US foreign and military policy. They went along with it. The Times and the Post suddenly began to run long stories on the supposed intelligence links, of course they started then, between Iraq and bin Laden. 8 stories in 1 week, I recall, each sourced to administration officials, intelligence officials, diplomats in Washington and London, all of them, of course, anonymous. I've just been doing a story myself in my own paper, The Independent. It would have been about 21st of January that the Times' Eric Schmidt wrote about a story about America's decision to confront countries that sponsor terror. Here are his sources. Each one is in quotation marks. The story wasn't very long, but just listen to the sources. Senior defense officials, administration officials, some American intelligence officials, the officials, the officials again, administration officials again, terrorist experts and defense officials. Is that journalism? You see, when it comes down to it, you find that we newspaper journalists just play along with anyone. Last September of last year, just before actually I came over to the States for the anniversary, the British newspaper, the Daily Express, not my favourite paper, carried this headline, "Nuclear attack in just months." A bit late now, of course, the nuclear attack hasn't happened. Was this going to be Piccadilly Circus? Downing Street? Tony Blair, perhaps? You know, it's extraordinary what newspapers will print and what people will believe. What does a journalist do about this? Well, I don't work for them. The problem is, you see, that over and over again, it obscures realities. Today, we are prepared to discuss the wisdom, or perhaps we've gone beyond that, of starting yet another war in the Middle East. There is, after all, a fairly bloody war already going on, if we want one. But we remain quiescent. We do not investigate just how target Kabul became target Baghdad, and in the coming days, perhaps target Damascus, or target Beirut, or even, since the RAND Corporation's pro-Israeli lecturer referred to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as the kernel of evil, perhaps target Riyadh. Even when our own dear Prime Minister Blair returns from the United States telling us that there may be a blood price that has to be paid in the event of war, not a single journalist points out that this will be a blood price principally paid by the Iraqis, not by us. Or if it is paid by young men, for example, from Manchester or Wolverhampton in England, it won't touch the family that lives in Downing Street. Richard Armitage, one of Colin Powell's deputies in Washington, announced a few weeks ago that the Lebanese Hezbollah, quote, may be the A-team of terrorism. Al-Qaeda presumably having been relegated to the third division now. Armitage said that the Hezbollah owed America, here we go again, a blood debt. But where does this word fit into the language of these men? Note how yet again we're on the move. First, the heart of darkness beats in a man with a beard who has a propensity to live in Afghan caves. Then he transmogrifies into a rather less-looking guy, a resident of Baghdad, with a liking for military uniforms, old British ones, I suspect, and a horrible moustache. And then now, out of the blue, it's the Levant, the Mediterranean, my home, Beirut, we should be targeting. Armitage's blood debt is presumably a reference to the killing of 241 US Marines in the American base at Beirut on the 23rd of October, 1983. But, of course, he doesn't say so. Very few reporters have tried to winkle out what all this means. I should say, by the way, that when I asked this question at a university in New York in December, you know, where did bin Laden get faded out and Saddam came in? He sat down afterwards, he wrote me a letter later and told me, he sat down afterwards with his giant computer and fed in Iraq, bin Laden, Afghanistan, Saddam, and went through the entire Washington Post, LA Times, and the Times New York. And he came up with something quite extraordinary. It appears that in a period of just 2 to 3 weeks, the references to bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, went down from about 500 to 30, and the references to Saddam went up from about 20 to 400. And the intervening period was the Enron scandal. Of course, there may be absolutely nothing to do with this. To its great credit, I should say that The Nation magazine in New York published on September 2nd last year a first-class article detailing the number of US administration officials who have previously worked for pro-Israeli lobby groups in Washington, or who still do. This at least might explain why the Bush administration now appears set to redraw the map of the Middle East along lines which Israel can scarcely dream of. No mention of all this, of course, in the television and media mainstream, in quotation marks, in the United States, and largely, I'm afraid, in Britain either. Yet still, our blindness goes on. Immediately after the 1991 Gulf War, when it was clear that the awful Saddam would remain in power, the United States government suddenly stopped making any reference to the Iraqi president. Sound familiar? No more Saddam. I remember how Colin Powell told a press... General Colin Powell then told a press conference I attended in northern Kurdish Iraq that the American government was talking to, quote, Iraqi officials. But he made no mention anymore of the Hitler of Baghdad. I asked him what had happened to the Saddam fact. Hadn't he told us that Hitler was in Baghdad? Why no more references to the man who had been bestialized, and not without good reason, a few weeks before? And Powell just shrugged his shoulders and went on talking about Iraqi officials. The word Saddam had become banned. When did you last hear President Bush use the words Osama bin Laden? Not for some months. Then it was Saddam. Of course, Saddam now has to be brought back, or was recently. Later, be sure, Osama will be brought back, if he doesn't bring himself back before that. You see, the real problem here, I think, is that we have begun to use, constantly, and accept the language of officials and governments. Note how almost every journalistic reference to Al-Qaeda now talks about how US forces in Afghanistan are mopping up, wait for it, Al-Qaeda, quote, remnants. This, by the way, means quotes, they mean adding words. The word remnants began to be used at a US press briefing in Afghanistan and has now effortlessly and without any self-questioning entered into the journalistic lexicon. We are always closing in on, hunting down, chasing, liquidating, cornering, arresting these elusive remnants. True, when US forces tried to ambush them in the Shaikot Valley last year, the remnants turned out to be around brigade strength. And true, the attempted assassination of Hamid Karzai and the car bomb in Kabul last year, which killed 26 people, suggests there are rather more remnants than we expected. Now we have almost nightly attacks on US forces who've withdrawn from, at least on December 11th, from one major outpost on the border. They were coming under fire every night from phosphorus rockets. They left it. 3 days later, Al-Qaeda came in and burned it to the ground. It wasn't great headlines there. Wall Street Journal carried a report on it, to be fair, but that was about it. Problems in Afghanistan. Big problems still. Now the drug barons are back in control. Read the UN's warnings about the massive new narcotics traffic that is due to restart when this year's poppy crop is in. And we can't even bother to investigate the mass graves of northern Afghanistan, in which our war criminal allies buried well over 1,000 of their Taliban enemies. So, let's talk about Iraq again, since we seem to be about to invade it. You know, back in October 10th of last year, the New York Times, I don't want to burden you with this, but I'm going to have to, carried a report about what was going to happen after the invasion. It's changed its tune now, though it didn't tell us that, you know, the tune had changed, but this is the story. The White House is developing a detailed plan modeled on the post-war occupation of Japan to install an American-led military government in Iraq if the United States topples Saddam Hussein, comma, senior administration officials said today. You know, if you look at the New York Times, count how many times the first paragraph ends with, comma, officials say. New title for the Times and the Post, officials say. Buy it every morning. The plan, New York Times, also calls for war crime trials of Iraqi leaders and a transition to an elected civilian government that could take months or years, no doubt. In the initial phase, Iraq will be governed by an American military commander, perhaps General Tommy R. Franks, commander of US forces in the Persian Gulf, or one of his subordinates who would assume the role, World War II again, of General Douglas MacArthur, who served in Japan in that role after its surrender in 1945. Well, very good, but you see, there's a bit of a problem here. There's no emperor of Iraq, is there? The problem for General Tommy Franks, if he really does turn up in Baghdad to play MacArthur, is that the one unifying sovereign symbol that held Japan together in the ashes of nuclear defeat in 1945 was the Emperor Hirohito, mysteriously absolved of all responsibilities for Japanese atrocities in the Second World War. His military underlings went to the gallows on his behalf. Excuse me a moment. Just so I can keep going. But in Iraq, the emperor, of course, is called Saddam Hussein. And if we're to believe the US administration, the caliph of Tikrit would be in the dock along with the rest of his war criminals. General Franks will have to combine the role of emperor and colonial governor, which is how America's whole imperial adventure might come unstuck. What if the mosques defy the American occupation? What if the Shiites in the south, or the Kurds in the north, set up their own secret administrations? Are we going to arrest all the imams in the mosques? All those who protest against Western hegemony? You know, it's interesting to note that after the 1991 Gulf War, a large group of Iraqi opposition figures, including many of the secularists, met in Beirut, where I live, and covered the story, in order to plan for a new Iraq, familiar phrase now. Fondly, of course, and vainly imagining that Saddam was about to go. But within 24 hours, the Americans liked this meeting very much, they thought this was very positive, but within 24 hours, the opposition, including all those secular men, made an announcement that it would not allow foreign troops to contaminate what it called the sacred banks of the Tigris and Euphrates River, at which point Washington pulled out. There were, of course, at that point, American troops in southern Iraq and on the banks of the river, but nothing like what there will be in the future, if what we're told is to be believed. So you see, it just might be, therefore, that the Americans need an emperor. Could it be, for example, that they want to reinstall the kingdom of the Hashemites? Remember, back after the First World War, we, the British, put the Hashemites on the throne of Iraq, courtesy of Winston Churchill, as a compensation prize for being kicked out of Damascus by the French. Could it be that Prince Hassan of Jordan, formerly the Crown Prince until King Hussein had different ideas, might be intended as the new king of Iraq? I'm sure the Iraqis would hope not, and I'm told that he doesn't want to be, but he did turn up, oddly, at a meeting of Iraqi opposition leaders in London a few months ago, and also on top of that, when General Franks dropped by in Amman 2 months ago, he did pay a social call on the good prince. I just put these ideas in the air because we're not getting quite that point across to us in the television newspaper stories we hear and read. But if Baghdad is to be our target this year, for the second time in 11 years, I'd like to take you back to the immediate aftermath of the 1991 war in Iraq and to something that many of us journalists fear will happen all over again. I'm going to talk about this briefly and show you some pictures that I've actually shown before in Harvard, but now they've acquired a rather frightening new intensity. In February of 1991, as we know, Saddam's army had been driven out of Kuwait. His soldiers lay, perhaps 10,000 of them, in the deserts of northern Kuwait and southern Iraq. His tanks were burning across hundreds of square miles. Oil fires, some set off by the Iraqis, some by us, turned the sky black. I noticed, going through my files for my notes for this lecture, that I actually have in one of my notebooks splashes of black. It was raining oil as I was taking notes during interviews. Then 7 years later, in March of 1998, on a routine assignment to Baghdad, I noticed something very odd. It started with a chance meeting with a lady called Murtaza Saleh, whom I'd met before. She was wearing a sort of turban hat, and she had cancer. God knows, she told me, maybe the cause is whatever they bombed us with. But she was a chain smoker. Her tragedy seemed a normal one, but then it turned out that her husband, a medical doctor, had died of prostate cancer, and three other family members had also died of cancer, some with no history of the disease. I began to ask other Iraqis if they knew of sudden new cancers in their families. An Iraqi official I was chatting to, I've got this thing about officials, one afternoon suddenly said to me, "My neighbour's baby is sick. Her name is Noor Mohammed Yunus. She is only 2.5 years old. She had, it seemed, quote, a sort of shining in her eye. The eye had just been taken out lest the cancer move to the brain." Then in Basra in southern Iraq, people reported the strangest vegetables. In the region, of course, where we bombed most and attacked much of Iraq's armour during the 1991 conflict. People reported the strangest vegetables in the market. Football-sized tomatoes, carrots of a strange purple colour, water that no longer tasted normal. I asked a group of women about the health of their families in the main street. One had a husband with cancer, another an aunt who had just died of cancer. Two other women interrupted to say their younger sisters had cancer, and so it went on. With two colleagues, one American, one British, I travelled down to the border. The last tank battles had been fought here in 1991, not in the desert, as many of us had thought, but in open farmland. There were tomato fields and cows grazing in long grass and small rivers, and among them were the scorched remnants of those Iraqi tanks so pulverised by American A-10 jets 7 years earlier. Then up walked an old farmer, actually a middle-aged farmer, whom I asked quite routinely whether there had been any cancers in his family. And with great sadness, he told me his own daughter had just died of cancer. No, he said, there'd been no history of cancer in his family. I still cannot remember exactly the first time I heard the phrase depleted uranium. As some of you will know, depleted uranium is a radioactive and chemically toxic nuclear waste. During the process of making fuel for nuclear weapons or power plants, the isotope uranium-235 is separated from uranium. The remaining uranium-238 is called depleted and is now routinely used in the manufacture of an armor-piercing projectile. It's called a depleted uranium penetrator. It is tough and hard, and we used this weapon in the Gulf War, and in Bosnia, and in Kosovo and Serbia. All over the desert, we reporters saw in the aftermath of 1991 Iraqi T-62 and T-72 tanks on fire. They were no match for the modern American and British battle tanks. And one reason was the DU warhead. It goes through the toughest armour. What actually happens is that the DU warhead bursts into flame when it hits its target, releasing as it does so an aerosol spray of uranium. The British Ministry of Defence acknowledges only a very low radiation hazard from this weapon, unless, of course, you happen to be the target or in the area or happen to be breathing in at the time. Some of the thousands of Western soldiers now suffering from what is known as Gulf War syndrome, tens of thousands, not only in Britain but here in America, think differently about this British estimate. So do thousands of Iraqis, including former Iraqi soldiers. An American military document states that, I quote, significant concentrations of DU oxide dust could be expelled from the fire in the event of an explosion after an appreciable amount of DU has been oxidized. Keeping out of the downwind plume or wearing a self-contained breathing apparatus will provide adequate protection. Well, they didn't tell us that at the time. Now back to 1998. After exploring the old battlefields from which the people of Basra obtain their vegetables and animal meat, I visited the hospitals, both in Basra itself and in Baghdad. Now, Tom, I'd like it if you'd be good enough to turn the light down now, because I want to do some slides for you. Now, when I turned up at Dr. Ali's clinic in Basra, that's Dr. Ali on the right, trained in Britain, Edinburgh, actually, what I found is that every one of these people, they hadn't been got there for me, I just literally walked in, that was my pitch, every one of these people had cancer. So what I decided to do was go round the wards of the children's hospital, where apparently many of the victims were. I just simply took pictures of all the children who had cancer. Obviously, some of these children would have had cancer anyway, but it did seem a huge amount. Talking to the parents of these children, there was one common theme. They either came from regions where there'd been massive American bombing, or from those areas around Basra, which were contaminated in 1991 by the explosion of DU munitions. In some cases, the children themselves remembered picking up pieces of old ammunition to play with. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you that all the children you've just seen were dead within 6 months. In the months after my first series of articles, readers of my newspaper, The Independent, donated $250,000 for cancer vaccines and medicine for these children. After endless bureaucratic delays, the United Nations said at first we couldn't take the medicines, and when The Independent said we would, we got the permission next day. Though I'd have to say that we had a 3-week delay from Saddam Hussein personally, from his office. We had a big problem with Saddam's regime. You better remember that and think of, you know, what Saddam's regime is like. But we got them in. I actually escorted the truckloads of medicine around the hospitals of Iraq, and the charity CARE did all the work. I have to tell you once more that within 7 months, all those children were dead. What we had discovered, you see, was an explosion of child cancers, of children born after the Gulf War was over in some cases, but who were now dying and whose death appeared to be intimately linked to the weapons we used in that conflict. Bomb now, die later. Now you'd think, wouldn't you, that the slightest suspicion of all this, even the most tenuous links between DU and cancer, would capture a few headlines around the world. But no. When I got back to my hotel after another day visiting the Children's Cancer Clinic, the so-called ward of death there, in Baghdad, I asked a colleague in an American news agency if he was interested in following up the story. I have not forgotten his reply. He's a friend of mine. World-weary and propaganda-haunted, he said, "Bob, I'm not writing about Iraqi babies." Some of our readers took a more serious view. They wrote to their MPs and they got replies which were as revealing as they were depressing. I'm going to show you now a message from a letter from Doug Henderson, Armed Forces Minister at the British Ministry of Defence. You'll find this very boring, but not quite that boring. We love to have these crowns on all our military things. It's the last paragraph I'll draw your attention to, and I'll read it for you here. "The government is aware of suggestions in the press, particularly by Robert Fisk of The Independent," I get a savaging, of course, "that there has been an increase in ill health, including alleged deformities, cancers and birth defects," note the word alleged, ladies and gentlemen, "in southern Iraq, which some have attributed to the use of DU-based ammunition by UK and US forces during the 1990-91 Gulf conflict. However, the government, the British government, has not seen any peer-reviewed epidemiological research data on this This really is the language of Harvard too, isn't it? However, the government has not seen any peer-reviewed epidemiological research data on this population to support these claims, and it would therefore be premature to comment on this matter." I'll take the letter off and relieve you of it at once. Official government letters sometimes include things which their authors must later regret. See, I like that bit about the peer-reviewed epidemiological research data. No, the British government hasn't seen any and still hasn't. And it won't, because, for example, one requested survey by the World Health Organization never took place. So comment is premature, and will continue to be, though not, of course, for the children you've just seen. Now here a quotation from a classified British government report on the use of DU in the Gulf War. Radioactive hazards from the use of DU munitions, it says, and I quote, can become a long-term problem if not dealt with in peacetime and are a risk to both the military and the civilian population. It would be unwise for people to stay close to large quantities of DU for long periods, and this would obviously be of concern to the local population if they collect this heavy metal and keep it. Inhalation of airborne DU dust particles can lead to unacceptable body burdens. I love that one. DU can also be a danger if it is taken into the body by ingestion or through a cut. If DU gets into the food chain or water, this will create potential health problems. NATO, by the way, used 31,000 DU rounds in Kosovo alone. Again, the whole issue of DU has been effectively deleted from our narrative of the 1991 Gulf War, as surely as it is to be expunged from any discussion today of the munitions we're going to use on Iraq again. In Afghanistan, the so-called bunker buster bombs, we love these bunker buster things, can penetrate caves, as we know. The US military told me, on the record, that depleted uranium was not used. Two British scientists suspect uranium was used, although they still have to prove this. As usual, and more than ever, we are prevented from knowing the truth. So I'm bringing the past into the present, rather than just saying, what do we do now? But I want to give you now a more personal reflection on the whole business of war on terror and Afghanistan and indeed Iraq. On December the 8th, 2001, I was attacked by a crowd of Afghan refugees in a village called Kila Abdullah, not far from the Pakistan-Afghan border. My car had broken down, and the Afghans, many of whom had lost relatives in the recent US bombing raids around Kandahar, decided to take their rage out on me. I was beaten on the head with stones, kicked out and cut. Rescue came from a religious man. I recall he had a turban, but I had so much blood in my eyes because they'd smashed my glasses, I could scarcely see him. He escorted me to a Pakistani police van. Sitting in the Red Cross ambulance on its way to Quetta, I realised how carefully I was going to have to handle the frightening and very painful event that had just occurred, and which I knew would be reported by my fellow journalists. I did not wish to be the source of another Muslim bashing story, the lone Briton savagely assaulted by an angry mob of Afghans. We've been savagely assaulted by them since 1842, and they've always won, by the way. It's not a tradition I wish to join. I hate the what and where stories that leave out the why. Some context had to be given to their fury, their anger, some reference to the fact that they had been most cruelly bereaved, that my sudden and very definitely Western appearance in the village represented for them the face of those who had just destroyed their loved ones. So in every interview I gave, I therefore made this point. Indeed, I said and later wrote in The Independent that if I was one of those grief-filled Afghan men, I too would have attacked Robert Fisk. Those who beat me, I wrote, were truly innocent of any crime except being the victims of the world. Almost every published and televised report mentioned the reasons behind the assault, except for the British Mail on Sunday newspaper, right-wing of course, which used AP's story, but specifically deleted the one paragraph which explained why I had been beaten. Readers might have been excused for thinking the Afghans are always angry, primitive, generically violent, and thus prone to beat up foreigners and bob on a whim, the classic Islamophobic story, and the response of anyone reading the Daily Mail. Later reactions were even more interesting. Among a mass of letters that arrived from readers of The Independent, almost all of them expressing their horror at what had happened, came a few Christmas cards, all but one of them unsigned, expressing the writer's disappointment that the Afghans hadn't finished the job. Here's a Christmas card. The 12 days of Christmas. On the first day, right? Robert Fisk, spelt wrongly. A.K.A. Lord Haw-Haw. This, of course, was the Irish and British broadcaster for the Nazis in the Second World War. A.K.A. Lord Haw-Haw of the Middle East and a leading anti-Semite and pro-fascist Islamophile propagandist. Here's hoping 2002 finds you deep in Gehenna, hell. Osama bin Laden on your right, Mullah Omar on your left. Yours, Ismail Zetin. We made it through 2002 anyway, so. But you see, the Wall Street Journal also carried an interesting article which said more or less the same thing under the subhead, "A self-loathing multiculturalist gets his due." In it, Mark Stein wrote of my reaction that you'd have to have a heart of stone not to weep with laughter. The Fisk Doctrine, he went on, taken to its logical conclusion, I'm quoting him, absolves of responsibility not only the perpetrators of September the 11th, but also Taliban supporters who attacked several of Mr. Fisk's fellow journalists in Afghanistan, all of whom, alas, died before being able to file a final column explaining why their murderers are blameless. Now, quite apart from the fact that most of my journalist colleagues who died in Afghanistan were killed by thieves who'd taken advantage of the Taliban's defeat, Stein's article was interesting for two reasons. It insinuated that in some way I approved of the crimes against humanity of September the 11th, or at the least would absolve the mass murderers. More importantly, Stein's article would not have been written had I not explained the context of the assault that was made on me, tiny though it was in the scale of suffering visited upon Afghanistan. Had I merely reported an attack by a mob, the story, like the one in the Mail on Sunday, would have fitted perfectly into the general American media presentation of the Afghan war. No reference to civilian deaths from US B-52 bombers, no suggestion that the widespread casualties caused in the American raids would turn Afghans to fury against the West. We were, after all, supposed to be liberating these people, were we not? Remember this in a month or two's time in another country. We weren't supposed to be killing their families. Of course, my crime. And the Journal, by the way, gave its column the headline, "Hate Me Crimes." My crime was to report the why as well as the where and what. I was crossing the Atlantic on September the 11th, 2001. My plane took off from Europe just after the first reports of the first aircraft hitting the first tower of the World Trade Center. And the plane turned round off the coast of Ireland when the United States closed its airspace. So I filed my first column to The Independent from my airline seat on the plane's satellite phone, without notes, dictating with punctuation to a copy taker in Manchester, pointing out that there would be an attempt in the coming days to avoid asking the why questions. This is my story for the morning of September 12th. I wrote about the history of deceit and lies in the Middle East, the growing Arab anger at the deaths of thousands of Iraqi children under UN sanctions, and the continued occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israel. I suggested bin Laden may have been responsible. I wrote that thousands of Muslims may soon die in Afghanistan or elsewhere as a result of the outrages in New York and Washington. Emails poured into The Independent, mostly in support of my article, but many demanding my resignation. The attacks on America were caused, quote, by hate itself of precisely the obsessive and dehumanizing kind that Fisk and bin Laden have been spreading. According to the same message from Professor Judea Pearl of UCLA, by the way, I should add that after I was badly hurt, the two people who most closely looked after me back in Islamabad were Daniel Pearl and his young wife, Mariana. I remember saying to him there, "Are you going to Afghanistan?" He said, "No, my wife is pregnant. I've got to stay safe." In any event, sadly, Judea Pearl, who wrote this before that terrible and vicious killing of Daniel, is Daniel's father. And he went on and said, "I am drooling venom and I am a professional hate peddler." Another missive, signed Ellen Popper, announced that I was in cahoots with the arch-terrorist bin Laden. Mark Gouin labelled me a total nutcase. Some of my colleagues might agree with that. I was psychotic, according to Lillian Barry Weiss. Brandon Heller of San Diego informed me that you are actually supporting evil itself. The article is only 750 words, ladies and gentlemen. On an Irish radio show in Ireland, a Harvard professor, whom I shall not name, it was Alan Dershowitz, of course, and now, announced that I was a liar, a dangerous man, and that anti-Americanism, of which I was obviously guilty, was the same as anti-Semitism. I have to tell you, the show's Irish presenter eventually pulled the plug on my favourite professor, but I got the point. Not only was it wicked to suggest that someone, in however perverted a way, might have felt they had a reason, or came from an area that had a reason, to see this mass slaughter. It was even more appalling to suggest what these reasons might be. To criticise the United States, or to be anti-American, whatever that is, was to be a Jew-hater, a racist, a Nazi. Merely to suggest that Washington's policies in the Middle East, its unconditional support for Israel, its support for Arab dictators, who do what we want, of course, its approval of UN sanctions that have cost the lives of so many Iraqi children, might lie, in again, however perverted a way, or be part of the context of the venomous attacks of September the 11th. To do that was an act of evil in itself. Oddly, the fact that the mass murderers of September the 11th were all Arabs, and that most came from Saudi Arabia, was not regarded as a problem by reporters or readers, or by the US government. They were clearly from the Muslim world, quote-unquote. This fell into the where and what slot, and Arab terrorists are familiar characters for many years from Hollywood. The sin was to connect the Arabs who did these appalling crimes with the lands they came from to ask the why question. They came from the Middle East. Something wrong in the Middle East, maybe? Is there a problem out there in the Middle East? You know, when the cops turn up, when the police turn up at the scene of a crime in New York. If the cops turn up to the scene of a crime in New York, the first thing they do is look for a motive. But when the crime scene is on a vast and terrifying scale in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, the one thing we are not allowed to do is look for a motive. How very odd. The killers were evil. They hated democracy, even though they wouldn't have known what democracy was if it got into bed with them. Now, I say all this because I do have a particular interest in Osama bin Laden. Back in 1997, I met him, and not for the first time. I'd interviewed him in Sudan in 1994, then in Afghanistan in 1996, then again in Afghanistan, in one of his camps the following year. That last night when we met, I was driven by one of his armed followers hundreds of miles across the mountains of Afghanistan, high up the rugged, towering Kabul Gorge. The clouds were below us, waterfalls of ice clinging to the rock above our Toyota. At one point, the gunman sitting beside me informed me, "Toyota is good for holy war." I imagine, a slogan that the Toyota company will be using. Bin Laden, however, does not make jokes. After hours of sliding and slipping on the scree, the rough stones above sheer precipices, we reached a plateau of stones and an air raid shelter 25 feet high and 25 feet wide, cut into the living rock of the mountainside by Bin Laden's construction teams at the height of the war between the Afghans and the Russians, a war, of course, in which Bin Laden fought with great courage, wounded 6 times, on our side. These were the camps, and this was one of the camps I was sitting in very shortly afterwards, which, of course, were bombed in the Tora Bora complex in 2001, and were bombed, of course, with great accuracy. Not, I suspect, because they were smart bombs, but because, of course, the camps were built by the Americans, by the CIA, though nobody told us that at the time. Didn't need radar pictures for your own constructions when the maps are in the Pentagon. So that night in Afghanistan, I waited in a tent along with several of Bin Laden's armed followers. An oil lamp sputtered in the corner. Then Bin Laden himself came in, lithe as a cat, but I thought with a slight infirmity in one of his legs. I was carrying over my shoulder a school satchel, same one that they tried to drag off me later on, which I use in rough countries to carry my passport and other documents. But Bin Laden saw some Arabic language Lebanese newspapers in the bag and seized upon them, turning to study them in the corner of the tent in silence for all of 20 minutes. He didn't even know that the Iranian foreign minister had just visited his own country, Saudi Arabia. And I sat there with his men, all of us ignored by Bin Laden, and thought how isolated he seemed. Didn't he have a radio? No television? When he did speak, it was with a determination, a very chilling new self-conviction, which I had not seen before. And I still have my notes of that meeting. What he said was this: "Mr. Robert, we fought and beat the Russian army in Afghanistan. We won our battle over the Russians from this very mountain upon which you are sitting, and that battle destroyed the Soviet Union. I couldn't totally disagree with this exaggeration. I think Afghanistan did destroy the Soviet Union. From time to time, bin Laden, rather disconcertingly, would clean his teeth with a piece of wood, mishwak wood, while I was asking the questions. And he'd go on cleaning his teeth for a minute afterwards when he thought what he wanted to say. But then he went on, and I always remember how chilling this was in retrospect. "Mr. Robert," he went on, "I pray to God that he will permit us to turn the United States into a shadow of itself." I could not, of course, fail to remember those words when I saw those terrible images of New York on the television when I returned to Europe. The World Trade Center had disappeared in two almost biblical columns of smoke, and New York, I suddenly realized, was now a shadow of itself. Just that one word, shadow, was so deeply disturbing. But bin Laden's power in the Middle East, comes from what he says rather than what he does. I don't think he climbs to the top of a mountain and pulls out a mobile phone and mutters Plan B for some kind of atrocity. Hollywood might have him do that, and the State Department. I fear, however, that his awful power and influence comes more from his words. Many times I have listened to them, personally present, his armed followers hanging upon those words as if he was a messiah or a Mahdi. He would demand that the American forces leave the Middle East, leave what he called the land of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. 7,000 American troops were there then, near to 20,000 now. He wanted them to leave the other Gulf countries, Egypt and Jordan, which torture their own people. He demanded an end to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He demanded an end to the sanctions which are killing so many Iraqi children under the UN sanctions, which of course are principally still supported by the United States. Whether or not he really felt that strongly, that is what he said. And his words have a special resonance in an Arab world which has for decades felt humiliated by the West, especially by America. A world which many of its millions believe has indeed been corrupted and damaged almost beyond repair by the culture and armed might and politics of the West. Without those feelings of despair and humiliation and fury, bin Laden would truly be a voice in the wilderness, ignored, derided, perhaps freighted to a hospital for the insane. But to many Arabs, and this is the point, to many Arabs who were appalled for both moral and religious reasons by the staggering massacres in New York and Washington, bin Laden does not sound insane, which is why his voice carries so much powerful resonance to tens of millions of people, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, I've spent now 27 years in the Middle East trying to answer the whys. And in no part of the world is our reporting so flawed, so biased in favour of one country, Israel, and so consensual in its use of words. Indeed, the language of Middle East journalism has become so cowardly, so slippery, so deferential, so locked into the phrases used by the State Department, the President, US diplomats, Israeli officials, that our reporting has in many cases become incomprehensible. Such is the bizarre nature of our profession in the region that any talk like the one I'm giving you tonight has to have a kind of mantra, a protective mantra. So here we go. Yes, Saddam Hussein is a wicked, cruel tyrant who invaded Iran, when he was on our side, of course, and Kuwait. Yes, he did use poison gas on the Kurds. The governments of the West did nothing at the time, but that's something else. His Iranian war cost up to 1 million lives. He does have a hangman on 24-hour duty at Abu Ghraib prison. Women are hanged on Tuesdays, and if there's an overflow, on Thursdays too. Yasser Arafat is a corrupt, vain little despot, allowing his 11, some say 13 secret services, when they could operate, to beat, torture, and occasionally kill Palestinian opponents. I should add that I never could see why Israel wanted to negotiate with him, unless they saw him as a weak militia ally who could police the West Bank and Gaza on their behalf, which I think indeed is the truth. It's interesting that after the Gulf War in 1991, all the journalists I know predicted the downfall of the two men who had shown sympathy, or more than sympathy, for Saddam Hussein, Yasser Arafat and King Hussein of Jordan. And yet these were the two Arab leaders who in the coming years would make peace with Israel. I think what happened is that they were then weak enough for Israel to make peace with. So if you don't support Saddam, watch out.